Dr. Andy Seidel is no stranger to Leaderboard. He is the director emeritus of the Hendricks Center. And today, of course, we have myself as the acting director for Christian Leadership, and we have Daryl Bach as the director for cultural engagement. So you can see it's taken two people to replace Andy. And thank you very much for your work there. Andy, technically speaking, is an adjunct professor in educational ministries and leadership at the seminary, as well as in the Doctor of Ministry program. He is a graduate of West Point, where he taught mathematics as well as at the University of Dallas. He has a master's from the University of Illinois, as well as a master of theology from Dallas Seminary, as well as a doctor of ministry from Dallas Seminary. He served as a colonel in the United States Army and was senior pastor for a number of years at Grace Bible Church in College Station. And after working among the Aggies for 14 years, God gave him a reprieve and reassigned him to train pastors in Europe and the former Soviet countries, and that work continues to this day through an organization called InTrust, which is the former Be International. And of course, with Andy, you also get his wife Gail, Dr. Gail Seidel, who is a force to be reckoned with in her own right. And we may have her well come and speak to Leaderboard at some point in the future. But the Seidels have two married children, six grandchildren. They live in the beautiful hill country town of Fredericksburg. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Andy Seidel?
You know, after leaving Dallas Seminary, there are many things about Dallas Seminary that I miss. It's a wonderful place. Leaderboard is one of the most significant ones that I miss. It's great to be with you all this morning. It's good to see you. And it's just a very great pleasure to be here. The only thing that I need to say about what Bill said is he gave me the title of emeritus. Is there any funding that goes with that? Well, I'm also an emeritus elder from Fellowship Bible Church, so my emeritus titles are growing. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Well, I want to talk with you about a particular topic in the area of leadership today that is very important to me. I first got interested in this. One week I was in Colorado Springs with the mission that I'm associated with, InTrust. We were having a board meeting, and as we were going through the board meeting, I kept noticing that the secretary of the board, she was sitting over there, and her face was just really crushed. And every once in a while, there'd be tears coming down her eyes as I kept looking at her, and sometimes she'd have a hard time responding. And as soon as we had a break, I went up to her and I said, you know, what's wrong? Is there something going on? All she could say was, my pastor. Well, her pastor at the church that she was in Colorado Springs had just been dismissed. He was a very successful pastor. He was founder of New Life Church in Colorado Springs. They had 14,000 members. He was president of the National Association of Evangelicals. And all of a sudden, one day, the paper comes out and they get the word that he has been dismissed. It was a train wreck. So many people hurt. The newspaper, I just took a photo of it as it came out that day. The dear lady sitting there, and she's just crushed because of the derailment of a leader that she trusted, a significant leader. Now, this is not just true in the spiritual world, in the church world. It's the same is true in business. It's true in the military. It's true in government. Psychologists have been studying this for a number of years. Dr. Keltner at the University of California at Berkeley, he has demonstrated that people give authority to people that they like. People who have wonderful qualities, like they're competent, they're considerate, they're personable, they're agreeable, They're easy to work with. Those are the people that tend to rise to power. Problem is that there is what psychologists call the paradox of power. Keltner goes on to say that it is an incredibly consistent effect. When you give people power, they basically start acting like fools. He says the traits that tend to give people power all but disappear once they rise to power. Now, there's a growing body of literature on this topic. The topic is derailment. That's what it's called by many people. Studies began in derailment about people who had a lot of abilities, but they didn't quite make it up to the top. So they did that for a while. Then they kind of shifted their thinking to the impact that stress has on leaders. And so they studied stress and its impact. But later research, most recent research, is really focused on kind of a surprising group of leaders. These are leaders who are very successful. And very often, these are the leaders that derail. And so we want to talk today about the derailment of a leader from 2 Chronicles chapter 26. You have that text. It's a long text, so I won't read all of it. But you have that text in your notes, and so you can follow along as I talk about this. Now, leaders can become very successful. We celebrate successful leaders. And by all accounts, the king that is mentioned here, the king of Judah, Uzziah, was a very effective leader. He was a very successful leader. He had a long and successful reign. He reigned for 52 years. Now, not all of that, there was part of that, as we'll get to a little bit later, that his son was actually in his place. But if you look at verse 4 of that passage, you see that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. Verse 5, as long as he did right in the sight of the Lord, as long as he sought the Lord prospered him. And so Uzziah was a successful leader. The Lord prospered him because he sought the Lord. And so he was a very competent leader. He, in fact, was something of a Renaissance man. There are five things that Uzziah accomplished. The first thing is that he extended the boundaries of Judah by defeating the Philistines, the Arabians, and the Munites. That's verse 6 and 7. Secondly, he impacted the countries and the rulers around Judah. Verse 8. The Ammonites to the north, they paid him tribute. His fame spread to Egypt to the southwest. He became very strong and he was respected by all of the countries around Judah. Third, he fortified Jerusalem in verse 9 and built walls. Number 4, he improved and built agriculture in Judah. Interesting comment there about Uzziah. That's why I say he's a Renaissance man. He loved the soil. He had cisterns dug and towers built throughout the land. He had livestock and he had plowmen and he had vine dressers. He developed the fields and vineyards. And then fifth, in verses 11 through 15, he developed a powerful military. The army was well organized. It was organized into divisions. There were 2,600 valiant warriors. These were the officers. There were 307,500 soldiers. So this was a huge army. And he is the one that built that put it together. And this army was well armed. They had shields and they had helmets and spears and body armor, bows and slings and swords. And he's the one that provided, the government provided that. Before this time, they all had to bring their own weapons when they joined the military. You could say, I guess, that Uzziah was the one who founded the military-industrial complex. He introduced new weapons technology. He built protected spots on towers and on walls of the cities where they could shoot arrows and throw stones from a more protected area. And so if you look at this, by any measure, Uzziah is a successful king. And the text gives you two reasons for that. You see in verse 5, God prospered him. Well, why did God prosper him? Because he did right in the sight of the Lord. Verse 5, because he sought the Lord. Here's a man who is a king who is aware of the Lord's presence and of his dependence upon the Lord. And so he seeks the Lord. He obeys the Lord. He does what's right. And so God helps him. Verse 7 and verse 15. And the results of God's help are that his fame spreads afar. You see that twice in verse 8 and verse 15. And he becomes very strong. But the problem is that success has an impact on leaders. It isn't always a good impact. And so successful King Uzziah begins to change. And so in verse 16, you have the first but in this text. This is the first of two very tragic contrasts. And the reality is that success brings its own set of temptations to leaders. Well, there is a number of articles and books about this. One of them is by Joanne Ciola in a book, in a message, Ethics, Chaos, and the Demand for Good Leaders from the University of Richmond. She says, the moral foible that the public fears most in a leader is personal immorality accompanied by an abuse of power. They call that the Bathsheba syndrome. It's really kind of unfair, isn't it? That David abuses his power and Bathsheba gets her name on the syndrome. She goes on to say that the interesting thing about the Bathsheba syndrome is that it's hard to predict because people get it after they become successful. Now, some of the further research on this is done by Dean Ludwig and Clinton Longnecker as they discuss the Bathsheba syndrome in the Journal of Business Ethics. They said there are really four things, four potential byproducts of success that cause many leaders to fall into ethical violation. The first one of these is complacency and the loss of strategic focus. What they say is that personal and organizational success often allows leaders to become complacent and lose their strategic focus, diverting their attention to things other than their leadership responsibilities. And so what happens is leaders get to the top, and somehow one of the ways this happens is that the thrill is gone. I've worked so hard to get up here, and all of a sudden it isn't all that it's cracked up to be. And so they begin to think, what, is this all there is? And they begin to let their focus drift to other things. Second, privilege access to information, people, or objects. See, leadership is a relational exercise. You lead people. You're involved with people. And as you become successful, people want to be close to you. They want to be liked by you. They want to be with you. They identify with you. And that can easily cross the boundary of intimacy. People want to be close to you. So the CEOs of Best Buy, Lockheed Martin, Starwood Hotels, all were removed because of inappropriate relationships with female employees. How can we have a general that respected so much end up having an affair with his biographer? You see, success leads to privileged access to information, people, and objects. Third, unrestrained control of organizational resources. The CEO of WorldCom owned hundreds of million dollars of WorldCom stock, which he margined to cover some of his other business ventures. And when WorldCom stock started to decline, he attempted to prop up the stock price with fraudulent accounting schemes because he had unrestrained control of organizational resources. Fourth, an inflated belief in the leader's personal ability to manipulate or control outcomes. I find it hard to believe that CEO of Tyco collaborated with the CFO of Tyco, and they both took unauthorized bonuses and loans of $600 million. I mean, how could they think that that wouldn't be discovered? But when you get to be so successful and you have this control, you think somehow you can manipulate the outcomes. And you can prevent your affair from being discovered, or you can prevent your stealing from the corporation from being discovered. Those four things, they say, make a significant impact on successful leaders, and they are often the things that lead them to derailment. 2010, the Navy studied 80 commanding officers who were relieved from their commands because of misconduct. Half of them were relieved because of adultery, inappropriate relationships, harassment, or sexual assault. And as they studied this, they came to the conclusion, two parts to this conclusion. They said these commanding officers either did not possess the insight into their motives and weaknesses to prevent them from knowingly engaging in unacceptable behavior, or they felt that they had the power to conceal their misdeeds. Uzziah's issue was pride. You'll find that very quickly, somehow, his pride became an issue. His heart was so proud that it clouded his vision, it clouded his reason, obstructed his ability to make good choices, and so he made a choice to act corruptly, and he became unfaithful to the Lord his God. The term unfaithful there is a term that is one of the most serious terms in the book of Chronicles, and it talks about someone who seems to take the place of God or try to take the place of God, to be unfaithful to God. He enters into the temple and he attempts to burn incense at the altar of incense. Uzziah is unfaithful in that he violated his responsibility to the Lord. He violated the fact that he had duty to give worship to the Lord and obedience, but he chose to violate and disobey the Lord who had helped him so greatly. You see, that was the role of the priests. It wasn't his role as king. Was the role of the priest, but he tried to usurp that role. He knew better, but somehow his pride disqualified him at that moment. Solomon said, pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Uzziah's pride somehow covered over the truth, and so he couldn't see it. Maybe it's like Bob Dylan said, the walls of pride are high and wide, can't see over to the other side. Uzziah, like many successful leaders, couldn't see over to the other side. Burning incense, the altar of incense, has always been the role of the Levitical priest. He knows better, but his ability to make good decisions has been hijacked by his pride. Now, pride gets mixed reviews today. If you read Joel Osteen's book, Your Best Life Now, he said you need to take pride in what God has given you. On the other hand, Billy Graham said self-centered, indulgent pride and a lack of shame over sin are now emblems of the American lifestyle. Pride is such a part of our culture. John Foreman said greed, envy, sloth, pride and gluttony, these are not vices anymore. No, these are marketing tools. Lust is our way of life. Envy is just a nudge towards another sale. The problem is, pride is a significant problem for leaders. Successful leaders are at risk for developing what's called the hubris syndrome. Hubris is simply exaggerated pride. Have a quote in there that in your text because it's so important. It's from the journal Brain. Hubris syndrome is an acquired condition and therefore different from most personality disorders, which are traditionally seen as persistent throughout adulthood. The key concept is that Hubris syndrome is a disorder of the possession of power, particularly power which has been associated with overwhelming success, held for a period of years and with minimal constraints upon the leader. Hubris syndrome. You see this in a number of places. If you look at Jim Collins' book, How the Mighty Fall, he says there are a number of reasons. Hubris is the first. He's talking about why companies and leaders fail. Hubris is the first. There are others: undisciplined pursuit of more, denial of risk and peril, grasping for salvation, and capitulation to irrelevance and death. That's the process. It begins with hubris. Hubris, incidentally, is one quality that the ancient Greeks did not want in a leader. Remember, in ancient Greece, there was something like equality between leaders and people. They valued each other. And when a leader had too much hubris, too much exaggerated pride, they didn't like that. That's why when Alexander took them all the way to the gates of India, they finally said, no, we're not going any further. Because as he had gotten into Persia, he took on the dress of the Persian kings. And he had his people actually bow to him. And all of a sudden, he elevated himself far above the men that he had led so effectively for so long. And finally, they got to a point, they said, we're not going any farther with you. And so they turned around and came back. The authors of a book I'll show you in a minute, Dotrich and Cairo, they defined excessive pride and inflated views of self-worth, arrogance, those things routinely derailed the best and the brightest. It thrives on success, confidence, and ego. Arrogance, from an organizational leadership perspective, is a kind of blinding belief in your own opinions. CEO of Home Depot derailed because of arrogant over-control, distance from his employees. He's noted for having a shareholder meeting in which he would not let his board come and he would not answer any questions. Every time I've seen him referenced in the literature, they all point to the fact that he is the one that he had 7 parking places in the parking garage for him, and he had an elevator from his parking place and went directly up to his office so he didn't have to interact with any people. I love this quote by Harvey McKay in his book, Swim with the Sharks Without Being Eaten Alive. There are 3 reasons why companies go out of business and individuals go out of business. Number 1 is arrogance. Number 2 is arrogance. Number 3 is arrogance. They all have chapped lips from kissing the mirror too much. Wellens Callcott said, beware of pride. It's a tumor in your mind that breaks and poisons all your actions. It's the friend of the flatterer, the mother of envy, the nurse of fury, the band of luxury, the sin of devils. It is the devil in mankind. Well, the nurse of fury led Uzziah to destruction. When he's confronted by Azariah and the 80 priests, verse 19, he becomes enraged. The priest says to Uzziah, you've got to get out of the sanctuary. And he tells him that he's been unfaithful and he'll have no honor from the Lord. And that was a wake-up call for Uzziah. He's confronted there by the priests. And he should have recognized what he was doing. And I think if he had, at that moment, recognized it, and if he had left, he probably would have been forgiven. I think the psychologist Carl Jung was probably a little too optimistic when he says, through pride we are ever deceiving ourselves. But deep down below the surface of the average conscience, a still small voice says to us, something is out of tune. Well, if the voice was there, Uzziah didn't hear it. And so you have in verse 19 the second but, the second contrast of this. He goes ballistic. He is enraged. William Hazlitt said, to the proud, the slightest repulse or disappointment is the last indignity. And so Uzziah gets enraged, and all of a sudden, the judgment of God comes on, and he breaks out in leprosy. Dutlich and Cairo, whom I mentioned before, they wrote a book, Why CEOs Failed. Notice the first of 11 is arrogance. Characteristic number one is arrogance. You can see the rest of melodrama, volatility, excessive caution, distrust, aloofness, mischievous, passive resistance, all of them. Number one is arrogance. And so God judges Uzziah immediately. The leprosy breaks out on his forehead. The priests rush him out of the temple. He lives then in a separate house for the last years of his life, and his son becomes king in his place. It's a tragic story of derailment. Hogan Assessment Systems, they talk about management derailment, and they say highly arrogant people expect to be admired, praised, indulged, and obeyed. They expect to be successful in everything they do. They believe in their own legacy, and when their expectations are frustrated, they explode with narcissistic rage, and that's what took Uzziah out of his leadership role, out of his kingship, into a little house set off to the side because he was a leper. It's tragic. As you think back over that situation, think about how do you avoid derailment? Successful leaders can avoid derailment. There are many things in the literature, there are many things that are said about this, but there are three things in particular that are important. And they've done this from all of the studies that they've done. This is these kind of things that are tragic stories, but they are way too often repeated. The first one that they mentioned to avoid derailment is openness and accountability. See, every leader needs a relationship with someone with whom that he or she can be open, with whom they can be vulnerable, they can talk about what's going on in their life, they can talk about what challenges they're facing, what the issues are. Sometimes it's a trusted friend, sometimes it's a mentor. Leadership Journal survey, it shocked me a while back when I was working with pastors, 70% of pastors say they do not have someone they consider to be a close friend. That's hard. If you're in whatever kind of leadership role and you don't have somebody that you can be vulnerable and real with, it will be a detriment to your maintaining that leadership ability. If you notice back in verse 5 of this text, Uzziah, through part of his kingship, had Zechariah. And Zechariah, we don't know who he was, but we do know that the writer of Chronicles, as you saw, connects Uzziah seeking God to the time of Zechariah. There was someone in his life that he trusted, who had the kind of effect on him to keep him centered, keep him focused on the Lord and then on his kingship. Such a person can provide wisdom in times of difficulty. They can provide perspective when things are unclear. They can also provide corrective to faulty thinking, an unwise decision. You probably should ask yourself periodically, do you have someone in your life like that? Someone who can provide those things for you? Or even in a more general way, are you open to honest feedback from your staff? Are you willing to hear what they have to say? See, some leaders only want to hear agreement. And they're usually the ones that derail. Some leaders never let anyone get close. But as this passage illustrates, the close effect of a person whom you trust and who can be trusted can have a very significant positive impact on you as a leader. The second is self-awareness. Now, we all have normal human needs. But the problem is sometimes these needs get to where they develop into stronger hungers that impact our ability to think or to reason, to act wisely. Ron Heifetz and Marty Linsky written a book, Leadership on the Line, and they mention the fact that everybody has three basic areas of human need. There's a need for power and control. There's a need for affirmation and importance. There is a normal human need for intimacy and delight. Which one is the major one for you? See, we all need to be aware of these legitimate needs, aware enough to know when those needs that are legitimate are growing into hungers. Because some of the early problems I had growing up, my most difficult needs always been affirmation and importance. As a pastor, one Sunday I preached a very good sermon. And as I walked from one building to the other building, I was walking and I had this feeling, yes, I can do this. Fortunately, the next thought that went through my mind was, that was a voice from hell. And fortunately, I had enough people, some on the staff and some in the congregation, that let me know that one good sermon doesn't make a rock star. One man in particular that really appreciated, he was not that much involved in the church. He was at one time supposedly the wealthiest man in the county. He lived at two streets. His house was at two streets. One was his first name, one was his last name. And one Sunday after I was preaching on Titus, I thought it was really good. He came up to me and said, "Preacher, you sure missed it today." And I said, "Well, sir, what did I miss?" "Oh, I'm not going to tell you." "What?" "No, I'm not going to tell you. You got to go back and study that again." And I said, "You're not going to tell me?" "No. Go back and study it again." And I said, "Okay, I will go back and study it again if you will tell me next Sunday what it was that I missed." And so next Sunday, I asked him, and he said, you kind of missed the whole thing." And so, you know, things like that make you stop and you think, okay, I need to evaluate, you know, what's going on here. So third way to avoid is sensitivity to early warning signals. You know, there's a lot of literature now on the whole area of emotional intelligence, and that's connected to leadership, because leadership is about leading people. And there's an emotional element to that. And one of the things that they talk about is the need to be able to relate to the person that you're leading and interact with them from a good position. And one of the things they talk about is just a little process of understanding what's going on in your own mind, in your own thoughts, at the very moment even that you're interacting with somebody. And they talk about somebody who is mature, who has a strong emotional quotient, is someone who can be in a conversation with somebody, and even while they're having that conversation, they can be kind of up on the balcony looking down and thinking, okay, why is he coming on so strong? Or why is my anger kind of rising here? What's going inside me? Even while they're having the conversation. And it takes somebody that is emotionally mature to be able to do that. And so one of the things that you can do in this sense to begin to recognize early warning signals is learn to kind of get up on the balcony and look what's going on right now as I'm talking to this person. I feel anger rising in me. Or I feel like I want to just kind of turn my back and walk away. Where's that coming from? And to be able to come out of that emotional understanding to be able to relate to the other person. Another thing that can be done is to do something of temptation map. One of the things that we do at Dallas Seminary in the Spiritual Formation Program is we have students use what C.S. Lewis wrote, the Screwtape Letters, to write a Screwtape letter about themselves. In other words, if I was a devil telling another devil how to tempt me, this is what he would do. And it's a wonderful exercise to be able to recognize your own things that are going on in your own self, and if you have hungers that have grown too strong, any of these legitimate needs that have become hungers, to recognize that and realize that those things can impact you, and so to learn to deal with them. You can make a temptation map if you think about what I just said about the three hungers that we have. What would be the most powerful way Satan could tempt you? To think through that. Would it be power and control? Would it be affirmation and importance? Would it be intimacy and delight? You know, what are some of the specifics? And if you were to take some time to think through that, it would help you immensely. Because you would be aware of some of these things the moment they come up, rather than letting them go too far. Affirmation, importance, those are, I think about that in so many ways. When I was in the reserves, I was on active duty at Fort Hood. I'd been at Fort Hood 2 weeks. I was going back to College Station. I was driving one of those really wonderful Texas highways, you know, it has two lanes and wide shoulders and all of that, and I'm just cruising to go back to College Station, and I notice a car come up behind me, and so I pull over to the side, you know, go on the shoulder, and he goes past, and I look over there, and he goes, and I go cruising some more, another car comes up, I pull over, so he goes by and waves, and after a while doing this three or four times, I notice there's a car coming up pretty fast behind me, kind of a sporty-looking car. And so I pull over to the side, and it goes, boom, right by. And I look over, and there's a young woman there. She's probably an A&M student going back to A&M. And she goes zooming on by and down the road, and so I get back over the road going down. And about 4 or 5 minutes later, I realize, man, there's something going on. I'm mad. You're mad? I'm mad. And I'm all tensed up and all of this, and all of a sudden, I realized she didn't wave. And then I had this, you know what? This wasn't because I was a good guy. This was all about me. This is about me wanting the people to tell me, yeah, you're a good guy. And sometimes, you know, we get caught in stuff like that. And that was a very minor one. But we don't realize what's going on inside. So the whole idea of being sensitive to early warning signals is very significant. All of these really focus on one thing. That's self-awareness. If Uzziah had realized what was going on in his life, he could have said, oh, this isn't for me. I'm not doing this. And he'd stayed king. Kevin Cashman wrote a book, The Pause Principle. Step back to lead forward. And in that, he asks Daniel Vasella, who is the chairman of Novartis, which competencies are most important to leadership? Vasella replied to him, while there are several business-relevant competencies, including conceptual abilities, strategic ability, and results drive, self-reflection is the most important personality-related aspect of leadership. Uzziah had had some self-reflection, he wouldn't have been removed as king. The first half of Uzziah's story is he did right in the sight of God. He continued to seek God and was very successful, but I hope your story will be he did right in the sight of God. He continued to seek God and was very successful. And that's the whole story. Would you pray with me? Father, we thank you for this illustration of a king who couldn't stay king because of his self-centeredness, of his violation of your laws. Lord, we take knowledge from this example. And I pray, Lord, for each person here, each man and woman here, that in the roles that you have given them in business, in ministry, in family, in community, that you would guide them, that they would be sensitive to your leading, that they would be open to looking inside themselves and being aware of what's going on within them so that they might avoid this serious issue of derailment, and that their lives in this community and beyond this, their lives would give honor to you and joy and satisfaction to them. And so we pray for your presence and your direction for each one now. In Jesus' name, amen.